I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is going to make his announcement today that he will be running for president of the United States. He'll do that in New Hampshire a little later on today. Christie is the self-proclaimed Trump fighter and battler. He's declared that he's the only one who can fight the former president the way it needs to be done. And while there may be some other Republican candidates who may welcome Chris Christie to be the fighter against Donald Trump, there is one candidate more than all of the rest that is actually welcoming Chris Christie to the race. It might surprise you who that is and why that is. So let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, we are going to dig into this pending candidacy of the former New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, how he will approach all of this, what the battle might be. But the beyond the headline, it really is not about all the other candidates cheering that Chris Christie will take on the former president. We'll tell you who is really excited about it in just a second. But let's start with some comments from the former governor of New Jersey in a March town hall in New Hampshire. He gave a warning to the Republican field, saying, "You're going to need someone like me if you're going to take on the former president."
Let me tell you something. You better have somebody on that stage who can do to him what I did to Marco, because that's the only thing that's going to defeat Donald Trump. And that means you got to have the skill to do it. And that means you have to be fearless, because he will come back and right at you.
So really interesting. The reference there to Marco was to Senator Marco Rubio back in the 2016 election cycle. You may remember that debate. We'll play a little clip of that in just a second. But that's where the former governor really went at Marco Rubio, tried to dismantle his arguments and his platform. And that seems to be what Chris Christie is saying. Hey, I'll do that to former President Donald Trump. Now, in that same town hall, Chris Christie went after President Trump for calling himself America's retribution.
Donald Trump said a couple weeks ago, "I am your retribution." Guess what, everybody? No thanks. I don't want anybody to be my retribution. I want a president who can give me hope. I want a president who can give me optimism by telling me not what I want to hear, but by challenging me to be the very best American I can be and contribute to our country in that way.
Now, really interesting. Those are two very diverse messages coming from Chris Christie. And the question is, can he deliver both of those? Can he be a candidate that is filled with hope and optimism and challenging the American people to be their best? Or is he going to be in the cage match against the former president? That will be the test. For a long time, Chris Christie has said that he can take it on, and he keeps referencing his dismantling of Marco Rubio in the 2016 election. I want to play for you just a little bit of that. Let's go back to 2016, and here was the moment that Chris Christie is referring to in criticizing Marco Rubio.
That's what Washington, D.C. does. The drive-by shot at the beginning with incorrect and incomplete information, and then the memorized 25-second speech that is exactly what his advisors gave him. Marco, the thing is this. When you're president of the United States, when you're a governor of a state, The memorized 30-second speech where you talk about how great America is at the end of it doesn't solve one problem for one person.
In many ways, Chris Christie was Donald Trump before Donald Trump, in a very brash, very head-on style that was clearly on display in that exchange with Marco Rubio back in 2016. But let's dig under that just a little bit. One of the interesting things is everyone talks about Chris Christie taking out Marco Rubio. The interesting thing was it was actually Chris Christie who dropped out of the race just after that debate. It was not Marco Rubio dropping out at that point. He dropped out a little bit later on after the Florida primary. Chris Christie ended up 10th in Iowa. He was 6th in New Hampshire, where he spent most of his time. And so the track record in terms of what he did or did not do, clearly he did score some points and some political shots against Marco Rubio. I don't know that that was the beginning of the end of Marco Rubio. I think there were other problems within that campaign. So here's the real issue, and here's the real think again moment, is Chris Christie saying, I'm coming in and I'm going to be on that debate stage with Donald Trump and I'm going to go at him like only I can. And you would think that all of the other candidates would say, oh, good, Chris Christie can go in there and do the dirty work and the hard work, and then we can just stay above the fray and talk about principle and policy. But here's the thing again. I will tell you who is most excited to have Chris Christie on a debate stage. And it's not Nikki Haley, and it's not Tim Scott, and it's not Mike Pence, and it's not any of the other candidates. The candidate most excited is Donald Trump. By having Chris Christie on the stage, by having Chris Christie in the race, it makes certain that the same kind of bare-knuckle politics, pejorative-laced explanations and declarations against your opponent will continue. And that favors the former president. Doesn't favor any other candidate than the former president. And so while there may be some in that Republican field that's growing and getting more crowded by the day, some of them might think, well, maybe having Chris Christie in the race will be good. He can beat up on the former president and they can go at each other and then I'll have a chance to get my message out. It will be just the opposite. It will be a back and forth between Chris Christie and Donald Trump, and that will drive the debate stage, and that will prevent anyone from having the conversation that we actually need to have as a country. And so to me, that's the real think again moment today. Again, a lot of people cheering that Chris Christie's coming on to take on the former president. I think the former president is cheering wildly that he will have someone to go back and forth with on the debate stage and ensure that the kind of politics that got President Trump elected in 2016 continue in 2024. So we got to think again about how this all plays out. And we're going to take a little deeper look. We're going to stay with the conversation on this and look at what all of these candidates mean, what they do. What does fracturing the vote really look like? And does it produce a result that is better or worse for the country? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Get deeper insights on the news from inside sources.
We're staying with the conversation just a little bit longer as we look at former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie jumping into the 2024 presidential race. And as we talked about in the last segment, I think the person cheering most loudly for him to be in the race is actually Donald Trump. I think the former president wants someone who is going to come at him, someone who's going to attack him verbally, someone who's going to be brash. Because that is how President Trump won in 2016. And having Chris Christie on the stage will create more the same kind of fireworks, the same kind of back and forth, the same kind of raucous crowd moments that have been good for the former president. So I don't know that Chris Christie getting in with that kind of mantra that he's there to take on President Trump verbally on the debate stage, I don't think is a winning strategy. And again, Chris Christie did not do well in 2016. He dropped out after New Hampshire. He finished 10th in Iowa. And while he often is lauded as being the one who took down Marco Rubio, that really isn't reality. It was actually Chris Christie who dropped out the day after that debate. Marco Rubio pushed on through Florida, and I think there were other issues that were at play there for sure. And so as we look at how that all plays out and what that means, of course, one more voice in there does create a little bit of a fracture moment. And I think that's one worth exploring and looking at. Many have said that it is an advantage for the former president, the more people get in. I think that's true. The former president has a very a narrow but very deep set of loyal followers. And so I think that is sort of what is at play. And that seemed to be part of what was going on with New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, who had definitely toyed with the idea, had explored the idea of making a run. And then he announced and then reconfirmed yesterday that he would not be running for president, citing that very concern. So take a listen to this. This is Governor Sununu. He said a candidate winning the Republican nomination, adding another candidate, would create more fractions in a more fragmented field that would not be good for the future of the Republican Party.
If we do what we did in 2016, you're going to have somebody win this nomination with 35% of the Republican support. That's not where we should be as a party. That's not where anybody wants to be.
But it's not just somebody for you. It's Donald Trump.
Well, it is. But again, it's somebody who is in the past.
Again, that backward facing is what they're looking at. Governor Sununu went on to say that former President Trump and fracturing the vote did factor into his decision and that other candidates should also take that into account.
Part of your decision is about the former president, right? Is it?
Oh, sure.
It's about the size of the field. There are 12. By the end of the week, there will be 12 candidates for the Republican nomination. Yeah. And you're not going to be one of them, but you think that's too big?
Well, it's look, I don't mind who gets into the field, but given where the polls are right now, every candidate needs to understand the responsibility of getting out and getting out quickly if it's not working. And I can be more candid about that. As the governor of the First in the Nation primary, calling candidates out, saying, look, you gave it a try. You're still in low single digits. You got to get out of the race.
By when? What's the deadline?
Christmas at the latest.
So that's really interesting. Christmas at the latest is interesting to me. That would be well before any votes would be cast. You don't get into Iowa until January. And so that's, to me, that's an interesting thing. There'll be a couple of debates starting in August, we know, late August. They'll start in Milwaukee on the Republican side of the aisle. And so looking at what happens in terms of that fragmented field will be very interesting to watch, see who gets traction. There'll be a lot of message testing over the course of the summer. And then when we get to that first debate, that's going to be really interesting. Now, let's go over to the left side of the ledger and take a look at what's happening there. Of course, we've covered a little bit of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Taking on President Biden, Marianne Williamson also in that category. And today, even further to the left, Cornel West, progressive, jumping into the race as a third party candidate. He's always colorful. He is wicked smart. And here's how he rolled out what he wants to do as a third party candidate for president.
I have decided to run for truth and justice, which takes the form of running for president of the United States as a candidate for the People's Party. I enter in the quest for truth. I enter in the quest for justice. We're talking about affirming. We're talking about empowering those who have been pushed to the margins, because neither political party wants to tell the truth about Wall Street, about Ukraine, about the Pentagon, about big tech.
All right. That was you should go watch that. It is Cornel West at his finest as he announced his candidacy for the People's Party and talking about what his agenda might look like. And some on the Democratic side of the aisle have said that's not good for President Biden. That could peel away some of those votes that he's going to need in what will likely be a close election, regardless of who the opponent is. I want to go back now to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has actually got some attention. And polling, we always say, polling is just interesting. It is not indicative of where the campaign is, because you don't win on a poll, and it's not a popularity vote. It's delegates that happen a state at a time, a district at a time, a voting precinct at a time. And so it is interesting that Kennedy Jr. has gotten a good chunk of just that percentage. 20% of Democrats say, hey, I can go that way. Here he was on Twitter Spaces yesterday talking about democracy.
The big advantage that we have over totalitarian systems is that the ideas that mature into policies are first annealed in a furnace of debate. And the best ideas then triumph in this marketplace of ideas, which does not happen in a totalitarian system.
That's so interesting from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. just talking about how we are a country of big ideas, and that is the way it's supposed to be, and different voices, and you debate it in the arena of ideas, and then you move forward. You don't want a totalitarian regime. That's not where we want to go. And so saying, hey, let the voices be heard. Let's not make this into coronations on either the left or the right, that we should have those conversations. Now, there are a number of people who still believe that it was Ross Perot that was just the splitter of things that cost George H.W. Bush the election and handed it to Bill Clinton. But the more you look at those numbers, things were sliding and a little different. So it's a little bit of a myth, and really interesting. Nate Silver from 538 and Steve Carnacki of MSNBC talked about this briefly, explaining what was really happening beyond just vote splitting.
The Perot myth, like many political myths, endures because no one bothers to actually check the data. President Bush was extremely unpopular. And so when you have a guy whose approval rating is plummeting every month in a downward spiral, then he was lucky to come as close to Clinton as he did.
There was not a single poll that had George H.W. Bush leading Bill Clinton. That was the case when Ross Perot was out of the race. That was the case when Ross Perot was back in the race.
And you can always count on those two for some nice background music to go with it as well. And really interesting just in terms of that splitting. And again, a lot of people are now saying that on the right, saying, look, it's we can't have a fractured party. We can't have too many candidates in. It'll be too hard. And I'm okay. I actually agree with Governor Sununu that there is a time for all those voices to be heard, and there is a time for those voices to exit stage left. I think his date is a little soon in December. I think you got to give people at least to Iowa to have a chance. But again, remember, it is so important that what happens on the ground in getting those delegates is where you really prove out if you have the makings of a presidential campaign. It's not just in the polling. You have to dig a little bit deeper. And so both the left and the right are worried about splitting of their votes and what that might mean in a general election. I still think it's going to come down to who can articulate a better vision. I think the American people are ready for something other than what we saw in 2016, different from what we saw in 2020. And hopefully we, the people, will start to vote and to engage and show what we're really interested in having as part of our presidential politics. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. More inside sources coming up next.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Of course, today marks the 79th anniversary of D-Day, the day when Allied soldiers stormed the beaches of Normandy, France, turning the tide of World War II. And we're going to talk about that throughout the show today. But in this segment, I want to go to a group of extraordinary citizens who, even before the United States entered the war, actually traveled to other countries to fight against Nazi Germany. I was tipped off on this story from Representative Abigail Spanberger, a Democrat from Virginia, who's been on our program on a couple of occasions. We've talked about immigration and a few other issues and some bipartisan work that she's been doing with our own Congressman Curtis and others. But she tipped me off on the really interesting story that was from her home state about some of these brave souls who, again, before the United States entered the war, actually went to other countries just so they could fight against Nazi Germany, and many of those stories have not been told. Take a listen to one Virginia man's ancestor who was one of those Americans.
When I was flying over Afghanistan, you could say I connected with the fate of my dad's cousin, and I realized how much of his story had been just washed away through time and how little remained.
Retired Marine Corps officer Michael Parkin was 25,000 feet in the air when he found himself thinking about his long-lost relative. Alfred J. Parkin was flying a bomber in World War II when the plane went down.
The idea that doing something that matters and then disappearing when worse comes to worse and being forgotten, just sort of a child's nightmare, being lost in the dark.
You see, Alfred's plane has never been recovered because Alfred did not serve in the U.S. military. The 26-year-old from the Bronx was one of the thousands of Americans that crossed the border into Canada, eager to fight Hitler even as the U.S. stayed neutral.
There's somebody doing something horrible in Europe, and he's threatening everything. All at once, a young man has a chance to fly, he has a chance to make a difference, and he has a chance to do something he thinks might be right. So he does it.
Soon enough, he was flying missions in Europe. On November 25th, 1942, he got into his bomber for the last time.
He was piloting a lone bomber that was picked off by Germany's highest scoring ace in the Netherlands. He fought back, he and his crew, for upwards of 20 to 30 minutes before being downed where no one could see them. And the squadron didn't know what happened to him. They just knew he never came back.
So that's Michael Parkin's story, which has left an impression on so many that you had these over 1,000 Americans who died while not fighting under the U.S. banner, but because they were so committed to fighting against Hitler and what was happening in Europe that they actually crossed the border and flew for Canada. And this is a group of heroes whose stories are largely forgotten. But it left an impression on Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, again, a Democrat from Virginia, who has decided that we need to make sure these stories get told and get told in the right way. Take a listen.
Parkin says that best estimates show about 1,000 Americans died or went missing while serving for another army in World War II.
These photos are from the spring or summer of 1942.
Now he's made it his mission to get them recognition.
This is a case of someone whose story deserves to be told, and it's not being told. And the longer we go without telling it, the harder it gets.
And this effort has reached the halls of Congress.
Our country has not recognized them for their service.
Virginia Representative Abigail Spanberger heard Parkin's story at an event in Fredericksburg, in a sense sponsored a bill that would give these veterans the Congressional Gold Medal.
By awarding the Congressional Gold Medal to these selfless Americans, you know, we're making sure that future generations can be inspired by their heroism.
But Parkin says that this is just the start. German records show roughly where Alfred's plane might be, right off the coast of the Netherlands. And he's hopeful that one day they can find that plane and bring Alfred home.
What would it mean to you to bring your long-lost relative home?
Everything. Everything. I want him back from the unknown.
Now, that Congressional Gold Medal bill is currently sitting in committee. It was co-sponsored by Mississippi Republican Trent Kelly. And Spanberger tells me that she's hopeful that they're going to get bipartisan support, in part because of the estimated 12,000 Americans who served in another uniform. There are service members from each and every state in the Union. For WUSA 9, I'm Evan Kozloff.
A great story there, and really grateful to Representative Abigail Spanberger from Virginia for sharing that with us and giving us a heads up that this was going on. And so again, the bill that would award the Congressional Gold Medal to these Americans, somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 of them, who before the United States entered World War II, went north to Canada, became part of the Canadian military. Many of them were flying planes in defense and in trying to go after what was happening in Europe. And so I think it's one of those things that we do need to remember. I loved what Representative Spanberger said, that by awarding the Congressional Gold Medal to these very selfless Americans, we make sure that future generations can be inspired by their heroism. You know, it's one thing to go into a battle because you have to, another because everybody else is in. But think of that. This was a group of over 1,000 Americans who were so committed to freedom, who were so determined to defeat Nazi Germany, that they chose to go north and fly under another flag so that they could take on and be part of a story of defending freedom in Europe and from Hitler's Germany. And so I think it's just a fascinating story. I hope this moves through committee. Representative Spanberger has told me that as they move it out of the committee and onto the floor, that she'll keep us posted so that we can continue to watch and tell these stories. And especially on a day like today, as we talk about D-Day and the countless lives lost, those that were willing to give that last full measure of devotion in the fight for freedom, we do have to remember forgetfulness is one of the great plagues of our society. We are so on to next before we're done with now that we often forget what happened just a few moments ago. And we need to remember, and some of the things we have to remember are those principles and the people who lived them, the people who fought for them, the people who valued them above their own lives and a willingness to do what the country needed to have happen so that freedom could continue. And we have to remember, forgetfulness is a dangerous, dangerous place to be as individuals, as communities, and most definitely as a society. All right, we'll go ahead and step aside for a quick break. More Inside Sources coming up on KSL News Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Washington, D.C. is the most powerful city in the world. It's where U.S. policy gets crafted, wars get declared, money is made, and a lot of our money gets spent. But behind our elected officials, there's also this very large bureaucracy with many a bureaucrat pulling a lot of strings. Really pleased to have joining us on the program Jason Chaffetz, of course, former United States congressman here from the state of Utah. He's also a Fox News contributor and has a new book out called The Puppeteers. So talking about those people who control the people who control America. And Jason, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Boyd. Appreciate it.
All right. So I want to get into a couple of components of your new book. And one of is this whole idea of the B team, kind of who is really at the levers of power and what should we be watching for?
Yeah, it's this bureaucracy, the administrative state that's kind of put our government on autopilot so that no matter who gets elected, no matter what the elections are, it doesn't really move the meter very much. I mean, we elect people all the time and then we wonder why things don't change overnight. It's because of this B team, and it's broader than that. But there's this great story I tell at the beginning of the Puppeteers book about a member of Congress who goes to meet with a cabinet secretary. Cabinet secretary is not there. It's just senior staff. And he gets very frustrated that he can't meet with the cabinet secretary and finally gets ready to storm off. And the senior staff said, hey, we'll meet with you. And he said, I'm not meeting with the B team. I want to meet with the cabinet secretary. And finally, the senior staff says, you're right. We are the B team. We be here before you. We be here after you. And we be the ones to actually make the decision. And that is so true. It is so true, Boyd. I can't even begin to tell you how true that is. And when you couple that with it, literally trillions of dollars that is set aside in everything from slush funds and climate funds and state treasurers and retirement funds and all of these things, you start to realize when you name the names and you follow the money that it's bigger. These are the puppeteers that tend to run the White House and others, particularly Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
Yeah, and it's so interesting as you start going down that path. I was never very popular as a chief of staff because when everyone would always talk about term limits for members of Congress, and I would always say, you can have term limits for Congress, members of Congress, but only if you have term limits for staff, because otherwise
we end up with what you just said. Boy, that's exactly the right answer. You're popular with me. That's why.
Well, there we go. but it is interesting how all of that happens behind the scenes. And it's one of the things I know you did in your role as the head of the Oversight Committee was to look at a lot of that administrative state, a lot of the regulatory stuff where, you know, Congress passes the bill that, you know, we shall all love puppies and have chocolate ice cream. And then they bequeath all the power to the administrative state. So when constituents come in and complain to the member of Congress, they say, well, you know, I just passed the love puppies and eat ice cream bill. But if you have a problem, go talk to the folks, you know, down at the administrative state who aren't elected and who don't really care.
Yeah, I think most of the lobbying actually happens in the administration. It's not so much on members of Congress. And And there's so much truth to that. Let me give you an example. The Inflation Reduction Act, which passed recently, it set aside $370 billion, with a B, for this climate slush fund that's run by John Podesta, who used to be Clinton's chief of staff, President Clinton's chief of staff. He ran the Hillary Clinton campaign. I consider him to be one of the puppeteers because he is now sitting in Washington, D.C. with this massive amount of money that it, when it was presented as the Green New Deal, nobody was going to vote for it. Ed Markey and AOC, they couldn't get it done. But then you put it, slap some lipstick on it and call it something else and say, hey, this is the Inflation Reduction Act. Oh, yeah, we're in favor of that.
Got to be for that.
But it's $370 billion.
Wow. So let's look at how
our entire state budget of Utah and Idaho, Arizona. I mean, you could combine the whole Intermountain West. And seriously, that one fund, and that was just a portion of one bill. That's why, in large part, you have the inflation that you have.
Yeah. Yeah. No question about that, for sure. And so let's talk about some of the things you get to in your book in terms of the solutions and how it really is. There are some things baked into the Constitution. There are some things in terms of federalism and states. Describe to us how we actually need to start to deploy that to deal with kind of all these other pieces.
Well, one of the things that actually surprised me doing the research and working with Jennifer Scott, who's been with me for a long time, is how powerful your state treasurer and your state financial officers are. Utah happens to have one of the best in the whole country. And my guess is most people can't name them, but Marlo Oaks in Utah is really helping to lead the charge. And we compare what's kind of happening in Utah and his leadership with other states versus what is actually happening in other states. Like the Democrats, we were able to unveil through a lot of good research and work and just getting out there and going to finding it. The Democrat state financial officers control more than $1 trillion. Their stated objective for their retirement funds in this document, it shows, as we laid out in the Puppeteers book, it shows that what they're after is implementing ESG and DEI and these things that people hear about, these acronyms, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and environmental, social governance. These are the things that are important to them. And they literally say in their document, Boyd, it does not matter who wins the White House or Congress. We have $1 trillion to play with, and we can actually make that change. It has nothing to do with return on investment. It's about implementing their Green New Deal.
Oh, fascinating stuff. And give us one last thing before I let you go. In terms of that best weapon, what is the single best weapon in the arsenal of the states to make sure that power gets clawed back to the states?
Well, the puppeteers, I'd like to point out all the problems, but I want to have the solutions too. It is your attorney general. It is going to be your state financial officer. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you also have to starve the beast. And if you don't start cutting back and you don't starve the beast, this thing will continue on in perpetuity. It is almost one out of every $4 to $5 in this country is spent by your federal government. Your federal government, that didn't even count all the state government stuff. And unless we start actually making some systemic changes, it will get worse because you follow the money, you follow the personnel, you don't make those changes, guess what? They become more powerful. And that's the fundamental problem.
Yeah.
This book, The Puppeteers, it'll scare the living daylights out of you, but there are solutions.
Good. That's because we always got to get to the solution. So, but you got to have the truth. You got to have the truth, and sometimes the truth can be scary. But
you got to understand it. Most people never heard these stories.
Yeah.
They've never heard them.
Great stuff. Jason Chaffetz, of course, former congressman from here in Utah, former chair of the United States House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, and his new book, The Puppeteers, The People Who Control, The People Who Control America. It will cause the hair on the back of your neck to stand up. It'll cause your eyes to get really wide. But there is a hopeful message in there in terms of how we get it done. And thankfully, it's with some good heavy dose of federalism. Jason, thanks so much for joining us today. Great stuff.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Again, that's Jason Chaffetz's new book, The Puppeteers. Really interesting, really behind the scenes look at where the money goes, who the power players are, and why in many instances it is some of these people who aren't elected by we the people who have the strongest grip on the levers of power. And when we're spending a lot of money, It's hard to keep track of where it all goes in these slush funds and these unelected people who, regardless of their motivation, are really pulling the levers of power. And the best way to combat it is right here within our states. All right, that wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for some top of the hour news, but don't go anywhere. We got a big hour number two coming up next. Stay with us.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, your all-day companion for news. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Ukraine's military, of course, has been striving to make gains against Russian forces in multiple locations along the Eastern Front. Some have said this is the beginning of their counteroffensive. No one is really confirming that, even inside of Ukraine. But this morning, we learned a critical dam in southern Ukraine was heavily damaged after an explosion. The dam was seized early in the war by Russia and has been supplying fresh water to annex Crimea. So the question is, will this threaten Ukraine's counteroffensive? What does it mean for the war in general? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, we want to go beyond just the headlines of where things are in Ukraine, and we're really pleased to have joining us on the program Anna Pechenkina, who is with Utah State University, associate professor there. And Anna, we're grateful to have you on the program today. And as you look at this latest developments coming out during the course of the day today, give us your sense in terms of where things are. What do you see happening?
Thanks for having me. So, of course, we cannot say definitively yet who's responsible for this enormous explosion that will have enormous humanitarian consequences. You see a lot of people now relocating, trying to avoid the damage. But there are a couple of pieces of indirect evidence that have been pointing towards Russia. So I want to be very careful. As of now, we cannot say that it was the move by Russian military. At the same time, you know, on May 31st, the Russian government approved a decree that suspended any investigation of accidents in hydraulic structures in the territories occupied during the war with Ukraine. In addition, Western officials, like, for instance, the spokesperson for the Pentagon, has been pretty unambiguous, so he has been less cautious than we normally expect him to be in a situation where we don't know whom to blame. So to me, that seems like evidence of him having seen intelligence that hasn't been declassified yet. Then another piece of evidence that I saw today was a video of a Russian soldier bragging about an explosion. Mm-hmm. And of course, these videos, you know, on social media could be fake, but it has been reminiscent of the explosion of MH17, that Malaysian Airlines plane in 2014, where local actors who were responsible for taking down that plane at first bragged about it on social media. But then after they saw the scale of destruction, because they intended to shoot down a Ukrainian plane, once they realized that it was an international airline, all of that social media stuff stopped. And of course, the dam is located on Russian-controlled territory. So for Ukraine, they would have to use missiles to attack the dam. So that would be also verifiable through satellite imaging. So we'll see in a couple of days to come who's responsible. But it does seem as of today that it's more likely that it has been Russian government.
Yeah, and let's talk about the implications of that. Obviously, the devastation in terms of those that are downstream from that. We know there's also the hydropower company there. But we also know this has impact in terms of nuclear power facilities that rely on that to cool reactors. Give us a sense of all of that, and what does that mean in the context of what's happening within the war?
Yeah, so as of today, I saw the official statement by the International Atomic Agency that said that as of now, right, that kind of early afternoon in North America, they are not worried yet about a nuclear accident. But of course, if you open Twitter, there's a lot of speculation that kind of this is a sign of Russians using a completely different strategy towards their war in Ukraine. But previously, they wanted to preserve critical civilian infrastructure, and now they're kind of, this is like an all-in type of gambling in the casino where potentially we might see some other disastrous moves by them. But as of now, it looks like dam breaking will affect a lot of civilians, will affect water supply to Crimea, and may have upset Ukrainian plans of counteroffensive, which we don't know about. As we none of the plans have been officially announced or kind of leaked in a way that's believable. So we don't know what the plan exactly was. But my understanding that it might have upset it. But as of today, it seems like that nuclear plant is safe, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully that continues to be that way. And so let's talk about it in the context then in terms of the counteroffensive. As you mentioned, we don't know exactly what that is. There does seem to be more intelligence mounting that is they are beginning a few of those kinds of things. And obviously, crossing waterways is one element for a military that can be a challenge. Do you think this dam breaking, is it going to impact Ukraine's ability to get in positions where they can better take on those Russian forces?
Well, certainly it looks like a very significant impediment for Ukraine to get to the other side of the Dnieper River, even though even previously it was a pretty difficult task as well. Russia's response is, of course, look, this wasn't us, because you can see that this is harming our kind of the territories that we are controlling. This has harmed. They have not pulled all the troops. There are pictures today coming in of Russian troops trying to escape and a lot of heavy equipment being left behind. But again, you can make an argument that perhaps in order not to this was a secret operation, right? If this was a secret operation, not to spoof Ukrainians, potentially they did not withdraw the troops for that reason.
Yeah.
So one last comment here is Russia's had a long time to prepare for the Ukrainian counteroffensive. And so any Ukrainian commander knows that kind of trying to break through what Russia is currently controlling, that about 20% of Ukrainian territory in the southeast that's bordering the Sea of Azov, that has, there is plenty of trenches, defensive infrastructure, but also minefields. So yeah. It's not as easy as simply kind of just pushing through, right? You have to be able to sacrifice quite a lot of heavy equipment if you want to push through. So I always expected to see the Ukrainian counteroffensive that would potentially use some of the attacks on Russian territory, which we saw from the Kharkiv, from the side of the Kharkiv region, because there you see less preparation by the Russians. And I think it would take them more off guard to start there. But again, we haven't seen good intelligence about this in terms of kind of reliable leaks. And it's hard to say what the actual plan was.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see how that continues to play out there. Really grateful to Professor Anna Pechenkina from Utah State University. Professor, thanks for joining us today. Great insight, great perspective on what's happening in Ukraine. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, some really interesting things as you look at how this breaking through of the dam, how it's going to impact hydroelectricity, infrastructure, obviously those that are being impacted just by the flooding in and of itself, how it's going to impact Ukraine's counteroffensive that many have been waiting for and many believe has begun. So all of that continues to be very murky. Which is what happens in this kind of war. And if there's any opportunity for Ukraine to begin to push Russia back out of their sovereign territory, I think the spring offensive is going to be a crucial part of that. What happened today is clearly going to impact it. We'll continue to follow it. Stay with us.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Well, our homes are becoming more and more like the homes our parents and grandparents could only dream of. A little bit of the Jetsons there, robotic vacuums, smart speakers, remote controlled everything. And despite all the progress, we're going to go back to bureaucratic regulation that might be taking us in another direction. David McGarry is a political analyst at the Taxpayer Protection Alliance. And David, great piece in The Federalist, talking about some of this regulatory stuff, some of the bureaucratic things that are happening that are maybe causing the home of the future to be a little less than of the future.
Yeah, good afternoon, and thank you so much for having me on. This is something that I'm really concerned about, because the free market and tech innovators have made technologies that make everyone's lives easier. They make things like cooking and cleaning easier, and they've really revolutionized what home appliances are like. Now, this should be juxtaposed with, as I note in that piece, the innovation-killing regulations that the federal government are cooking up. We've seen a real full-on assault from the Biden administration. We've seen attempted regulations to make more environmentally friendly all sorts of appliances, ranging from your stovetop to your showerheads. And it's going to, in the end, not only hamper the market and hamper innovation, but it's also going to make your home costlier and less effective.
Yeah, and really interesting just on some of those things. Again, things that get done by executive order or things that get done by a rule of some, you know, portion of the government bureaucracy can impact things that are way downstream that most people don't think about. You point out even, you know, a lot of home chefs just like the temperature of cooking with gas as opposed to otherwise. And how are all of these regulations going to kind of have that practical, tactical impact in terms of what's actually happening in our homes?
Well, you actually bring up a really great point, which is that different consumers are going to want different things. So some consumers are going to prefer the heat variability that comes with a gas stove. Others are going to prefer an electric range, and they should be free to choose which one suits their needs best. Instead, the Department of Energy is saying it's for you. And they actually say that both the stove rule and also many of these other similar regulations are going to make things cheaper. However, by their own estimates, it's going to these efforts are going to save Americans very, very few dollars per year. And also, I'm not even convinced that their estimates are correct. We know that regulators serially overestimate the benefits of their initiatives. And as I point out in the piece, there was a Department of Energy estimate done on the weatherization assistance program. And upon review, it was found that the DOE came up with novel types of formulas. They really used to have abstract reasoning in order to cast their preferred programs in a better light than they actually deserved.
And we know there's been things like this in the past. We know there was sort of the war on light bulbs there for a while. And when you start looking at that in terms of net result, net impact in terms of benefit to the environment, net impact in terms of cost when it goes to consumer, it sort of seems to be same song, different chorus with a lot of these regulations that sound good on the front end, but in the end may not even produce the results they're touting.
I think that's 100% right. Not only is it same song, same chorus, but the entire album is full of stinkers that sound exactly the same. It's the mark of a bad band. But the key point here that you're making is that all of these changes would have at best marginal effects on the environment. In fact, I think these effects would be vanishingly small. And using these vanishingly small promise effects, the Department of Energy and really the Biden administration as a whole is proposing to revolutionize and technocratically micromanage the entire American home.
And that's what could possibly go wrong there. I guess is the framing. So as we look at the path forward on a lot of this, what seems to be happening in terms of Congress? Will Congress ever be in a place where they can claw back some of that regulatory authority that they seem to love to give away, because then they don't have to be accountable? But in the end, it really isn't the way the system is designed to run.
Well, I'm actually really fired up about this, because just this afternoon,
some Republicans, about 10 Republicans in Congress, held up a procedural vote that would have allowed the House to actually get to the real vote on a bill to push back against some of the Biden administration's proposed regulations on gas stoves. And I think whether or not these resolutions from Congress can actually get through to Biden's desk and get signed, which I think is probably very unlikely, given the fact that all of Biden's vetoes have been against Congress's efforts to push back against his administrative overreach. But nevertheless, I think it's really important for Congress to go on the record, stand up for its institutional power and institutional integrity. You know, Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1 of the Constitution says all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in the Congress of the United States. And that is how the United States government is designed to work.
Yeah, and so important. The Article 1 powers are so crucial, and we've gotten them so backwards over the last couple of decades in terms of both, you know, Republicans and Democrats alike have abdicated that to the agencies or to the executive branch. The executive branch is all too happy to take it and do things by executive order, and then somebody files a lawsuit, and then it ends up in the Supreme Court, and we sort of have this vicious cycle going on. And I couldn't agree more with you that it is having Congress stand up, take votes that matter so that people can be accountable and that they can begin to claw back that Article 1 power.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that this vicious cycle has done a lot to toxify our political culture as well outside of the actual policy issues. Because as you say, Congress either offloads its power onto the president or the president simply takes the power. And this leaves the court system in a very awkward position where they're forced to appear as a very active or interventionist court, when really all that they're saying is that what the Congress and what statutes say is what, or I should say what the Constitution and what statutes say are what the Constitution and the statutes mean, and then make those orders. And whenever I hear someone complaining about the Supreme Court being a quote-unquote activist court or this or that or the other thing, my first thought is, well, stop passing unconstitutional laws or stop passing illegal regulations, and the court will have no need to intervene.
That's right. Yeah. And usually that reasoning why the court is so politicized is because Congress isn't doing its job or the executive branch is doing the overreach. And such a fascinating thing. And it does become very circular in all of that. David McGarry is a policy analyst at the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. This is some important conversations in terms of just that bureaucratic regulation that goes on that we often don't see because it's behind the scenes. It's that lever of power that gets pulled that can impact everything, including your kitchen sink, your dishwasher, your light bulb, and your gas stove. So all of those things come into play. But David, great piece in The Federalist, and thanks for joining us today. Great insight.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Really important stuff there from David McGarry. And I think this is part of the conversation today, is that we just have to look at who's pulling the strings behind the curtain. And it should be Congress, and they should be doing it in front of the curtain, in front of all of us, so that we can see. And so that then we can hold people accountable for what gets done and what does not get done. Rather than having all of these things be done by these sweeping generalities and then, you know, little lines in bill text that say, you know, we hereby bequeath the power to decide all the rules and how to enforce them and what the penalties are to some agency, or when presidents of either party just use executive order. Again, it always starts a process that ends up in a very political court, which is not how we want that to be. It's not the way the founders designed it. And as David pointed out, it is time to get back to Article 1 powers on everything, whether it's just dealing with your light bulbs and your gas stove or federal land here in the state of Utah. All of those things. We need to get back to having Congress do its job. It makes it a whole lot easier for everybody else. All right, we're going to go ahead and step aside for some bottom of the hour news. Much more to come on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Stay with us.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
While we've seen the number of illegal border entries drop in recent weeks, there's still clearly a problem at the border that needs to be solved. And could it be a bilateral approach to U.S. legal migration by working with Mexico that could be part of the solution that would really work in the best interest of both countries? This is one of those conversations we have to get to. And really grateful to have joining us on the program today, David Beer, Associate Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute. And David, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So let's dig into this. Obviously, still challenges at the border, to be sure, but Cato Institute had a great piece in terms of talking about how we could have this bilateral approach that could actually help both countries deal with this a little bit better.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, what's happening at the border now is the administration has worked out some programs that let people apply to come legally. And so they're not showing up at the border as much. It's pretty self-explanatory why that would be the case. If you don't have to cross the border illegally, you don't have to hire a smuggler, you don't have to go through all these processes, you know, that's a benefit to you. So you're not going to go through that illegal route. Unfortunately, they're really only focused on four countries plus Ukraine. And so there are many people traveling up through Central America and into Mexico and still coming to the border. And right now, the plan for those people, according to the administration, is they have to apply to enter legally using a phone app at the border. And as a result of the fact that there aren't enough slots available to enter through this phone app, many people end up crossing the border illegally. You know, you can't hang out in Tijuana homeless forever. So lots of people end up crossing the border illegally as a result of that. And so the proposal here is, look, Mexico, they have the same problem, really, as us.
Right.
They have people entering their country illegally, and then they're faced with a question of how do we deal with this, you know? And a lot of the time they're saying, well, we'll issue them some kind of humanitarian status once they show up at the border. And then they travel up to the U.S. border, and then the U.S. policy is, well, okay, once you're here, we'll try to figure out some way to let you apply into this phone app. And so lots of people are traveling up through Mexico, and it's all disjointed. And it results with a lot of people showing up the border, and then the U.S. has to deal with it. And it's really not in the interest of either Mexico or the U.S. to have it the situation developing the way it is. So a much better policy would be to say, okay, Mexico, if you're going to let people in, you should coordinate with us. They apply in advance to enter Mexico. They're entered into some U.S. process in Mexico where they're applying well in advance of them getting to the border. There's no backup at the border. They're not waiting at these dangerous border cities. And it's much more coordinated to prevent some of the illegal immigration that we're seeing.
Yeah, and I think that's such an important part of the process there is to just figure out, one, how do we get rid of that disjointed process that you just described? And the fact that Mexico and the U.S., that we can take law and order and we can take compassion, and that those are compatible principles, and we just need to figure out the way to get the process right. Because I think no one wants thugs and bad guys going into their country, whether it's going into Mexico or coming into the United States. And there are also people who have very complex, very challenging, very dangerous situations where they should be able to get an asylum or be able to get into the country somehow. Does there seem to be an appetite or is this the beginning of a bilateral process that might actually help prove those principles actually are compatible?
Yeah, so the administration, you know, they have been working with Mexico. Mexico's agreed to take some people back who don't qualify for asylum in the United States. And so, you know, there are talks happening. But again, you know, the fundamental problem is, you know, Mexico is dealing with illegal immigration. They're letting people come up, like I said, and ultimately crowding at the U.S.-Mexico border. And so they really haven't worked out a deal on, well, how do we deal with these legal options
right,
in a way that prevents this kind of situation from developing?
I think that's such an important part. Is there anything that you're watching for in terms of any movement on any of those fronts, whether it's from the U.S. side or from Mexico or a combination?
Well, really, the administration's approach right now, I think, is a little bit of a standstill because there are Republican governors who are suing to stop them from letting anyone in legally. And if that lawsuit is successful, to that, you know, they shut it down, then we're going to see a whole new situation at the border again. You know, all the numbers that we've seen go down the last few months, they're going to go way back up, and that's going to push both Mexico and the U.S. back to the table on drawing board and coming up with new solutions and new ideas about how to deal with this.
Yeah, great insight. David Beers, the Associate Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute, and David, great piece. And this gets so complicated in so many levels, so we appreciate you helping us navigate through it and figure out what that path might ultimately look like in the end.
Thank you.
All right. Again, that's David Beer from Cato Institute. And these are all complicated, complex things as you've got people moving from South America into Mexico, Mexico into the U.S., and all kinds of different needs and challenges that are going on there. And some of these opportunities, I think, for a bilateral approach can be good for both countries. If you just streamline that system a little bit, get some clarity in terms of how that can be done a little bit more efficiently, a little bit more effectively. And again, balancing rule of law and compassion. Those are compatible principles, and we should remember that as we're looking at the policy that goes along with those principles. All right, we're going to go ahead and step aside for one last break. When we come back, we will spend a moment to reflect and do that all-important thing. Remember D-Day 79 years ago. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
You know, when we often look at what a difference a day can make, this day, June the 6th, is one of those days that did make a difference in the course of history, clearly made a difference in the cause of freedom, because it was on this day, June the 6th, 1944, over 156,000 American, British, and Canadian forces executed what I think has to still be the largest amphibious military assault in history. Over 4,000 soldiers lost their lives on the beaches of Normandy, thousands more wounded that day. But those brave soldiers made that one day the beginning of the end of the war in Europe. Now, it was just a day, but it was a crucial day in the cause of freedom. And as we talked about a little bit earlier in the program, this whole important principle of remembering and an equally important principle of not forgetting. Forgetfulness, I think, is really one of our challenges in our modern society. It is so easy to forget and to just keep moving on. We do it every day. We have this race and chase coming at us 100 miles an hour. We have social media feeds that are just streaming a constant barrage of information. Some of it good, a lot of it meh, some of it bad, but we just keep moving. And even the good stuff that we get is often lost because something else popped up in our feed and we're like squirrels chasing it. And so on a day like today, as we celebrate the 79th anniversary of D-Day, it is a time to stop and to slow down and to remember. I've said it many times on this program, what we ignore or what we forget, our children are not likely to know. And what our children don't know, our grandchildren are not going to possess. It just doesn't happen. And so let's pause for a minute today on the 79th anniversary of D-Day. I actually want to go to Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who was in Normandy, France today, where he delivered a speech on this anniversary day. Here's what he had to say about the battle.
It's easy to forget how desperate the battle was, how loud the clash was, how many things could have gone wrong, how many things did go wrong. But on D-Day, courage won out over terror, daring over cruelty, and liberty won out over tyranny.
Again, that was Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin today in Normandy. He went on to say that these soldiers fought courageously against that tyranny in a way truly unique in human history.
Historians have known that free soldiers will fight more bravely than the armies of tyrants. The man who landed here on D-Day did just that. And they wrote themselves into the pages of history.
I want to stay with Secretary Austin. Again, this was at Normandy today. He said the soldiers who fought on D-Day left a legacy that not just endures the test of time, is not just recorded in the history books, but should really carry all of us beyond.
Ladies and gentlemen, today's open world of rules and rights was built on the shoulders of those who took the beaches, Cold Maine, Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword. Today's rules-based international order is the legacy of those who won the bloodiest war in history. And it is our task to carry forward their mighty work.
And finally, Secretary Austin said that we have a responsibility to keep the flame of freedom burning.
The eyes of the world are still upon the heroes of D-Day. They are upon us as well. And we will not let the torch of freedom go out.
Now, there aren't very many left who experienced that day. Those that are 100 in age and won't be with us all that much longer, which means the stopping and remembering and the making sure that we learn the lessons of that day are fully entrenched and fully engraven on hearts and minds, because that is the one sure way to make sure that tyranny does not get a foothold, that freedom continue to be driven forward. I want to go for a second to something written by the editorial board of the Deseret News today, talking about the invasion. The editorial board wrote that the remarkable thing about the Normandy invasion is that the soldiers involved fully understood what they were doing. I think that's an important piece of the puzzle. They knew that most of them were not going to survive the day or survive the storming of those beaches. But D-Day was a pivotal moment in World War II, not just for the U.S. soldiers, but for the Allied forces and for the world. And I think the way we look at things like that in history, it's so easy to just forget about it or to think it's some movie that we've watched depicting something that took place in World War II. This is reality. And unless we're fully steeped in what the reality was, there's no way for us to really understand what the current reality is. Because if you don't understand the price that was willingly paid, you can't understand the blessing that it brought. And so to me, again, that is the test of a day like today. Is it just another June day? Is it just another early summer day? Or is it a day that we really reflect on the legacy of those who knew full well what they were being asked to do? They knew full well that their chances of surviving the day were not great. But knowing full well what was at stake, those heroes stepped up. And they leaned in. And they did the impossible, clearly the improbable, and it turned the tide in the course of history. And everyone who breathes free today should be grateful for that. And then we have to ask ourselves, what are we willing to do? We may not be asked today to storm a beach or to potentially sacrifice our life, but there sure are a lot of things that we could do that might honor those who paid that price or who were willing to act heroically, to act greatly in the face of tyranny. And so that's the invitation today. So what is it? What are you willing to do in your piece of all of this? All of you that are listening are breathing free. We've all been given a great legacy by those who were willing to act greatly in a crucial moment in history. And so what will we do? Doesn't have to be anything on the front page of the news. Doesn't have to be anything that's going to be written in the history books. But are we willing to do something today that might make a difference for a neighbor? Would be we be willing to put down our weapons of war, whether that's a pen or a keyboard or an argument? Are we willing to lean into the conversations we need to have in this country about a whole host of things, from racism to immigration to poverty to addiction to a host of other things? So what are we willing to actually do? D-Day is an extraordinary day with extraordinary heroes, and we carry that legacy, which also comes with a mighty responsibility. I'm Boyd Matheson. Thanks for joining us on Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.